Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Later in the hour, we discuss the little-known but significant contributions made by women during World War II. We revisit a conversation with Liza Monday about her book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreaker of World War II. But first, the Mercy Otis Warren Cape Cod Woman of the Year Award is given to a woman who's made significant contributions to the community in one of several categories. Nominations are now open for this year's award, so we thought it a good opportunity to learn more about the woman who inspired the award and some of the past recipients. With us is Alice George, who sits on the selection committee for the Mercy Otis Award. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you very much, Mindy.
Also with us is Mary LeClaire, 2009 recipient of the award. Hi, Mary.
Hi, nice to see you.
So, Alice, tell us more about the award itself. What is the purpose and what is the criteria for nominations?
Very good. I would like to thank you, Mindy, and the staff of The Point for this opportunity to encourage your listeners to support this community award. I'd like to tell you about how it came about. It came about as a result of the erecting of the statue of James Otis, who is known as the Patriot, that is on the lawn of the county courthouse. After it was completed, the board thought it was appropriate to construct a statue of his sister, Mercy, who was so influential at the time of the American Revolution. This is a countywide project and is supported by the County of Barnstable government. And now about Mercy. Mercy was born in the village of West Barnstable in 1728. She was the third of 13 children born to James and Mary Otis. Her older brother, James, known as the Patriot, was recognized as one of the Sons of Liberty in 1760. Mercy has been called the First Lady of the American Revolution. In an era when it was unusual for women to obtain any schooling beyond reading and writing, Mercy's father, Judge Otis, allowed her to study with the West Parish Reverend Jonathan Russell. At the same time, he tutored her brothers in preparation for Harvard College. When Mercy married James Warren, who was a classmate of James Otis, she became increasingly active in his political life, and their home became a focal point of local politics. Encouraged by her husband, who fondly called her the scribbler, Mercy published poems, plays, pamphlets that challenged British royal authority and urged colonial resistance. Later, during the debate over the United States Constitution, she advocated for the inclusion of the Bill of Rights. Mercy also emphasized the importance of women in politics and society. Mercy Otis Warren is still recognized as one of the most influential women in the history of our country. In 1943, a Liberty ship, the SS Mercy Warren, was launched in her honor. She was posthumously inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame in Seneca Falls, New York. And Mercy Otis Warren was more than a woman ahead of her time. She was a beacon of light that would have illuminated any era. And now, and maybe we could talk to have Mary LeClaire give us the criteria for the award and pertinent dates
yes.
for the nomination.
All right. Go ahead, Mary.
Okay. Each year, as Alice has said, the Mercy Otis Warren Woman of the Year Award recognizes an exceptional woman who embodies leadership and service, reflecting the legacy of Mercy Otis Warren. This prestigious award celebrates individuals who have made notable contributions to the arts, business, education, and community service through volunteerism.
So how much do we know about her life aside from her writings? You know, and did she have a community of like-minded women, or was this pretty much men that she associated with?
Well, her best friend was Abigail Adams.
Ah.
And she and actually they were the couples, Abigail and Mercy, and the two husbands were very good close friends. Mm-hmm. And there was times when they disagreed too, and in a speech I wrote about them once, I said, I'd love to sit at a table having dinner with the four of them. Wouldn't that
That would have been really interesting, right?
have been fun?
Alice, was she recognized at the time for her contributions?
Well, in the day, she had to write anonymously all these pamphlets. But ultimately, when she was 77 years old, she published under her own name A History of the American Revolution. So she had a very long and productive life. And she used her considerable talents to promote the independence of the United States of America from Great Britain. And she was recognized in her day as an intellect. When after she married James Warren, who was a general and worked with George Washington, she moved to Plymouth with her family. She was a mother of five, and she ran the family farm during the Revolution, plus doing all this writing.
Wow.
So she was not only a brilliant writer, creative, but she was a mother to five, and a productive member of her community, supporting the family through this farm.
Wow,
So she was a very well-rounded person, and we think is a quite a role model for anyone in our community who has been active and is able to have somebody nominate them for this prestigious award.
Do you know how the wider community, particularly men in the positions of authority, received her literary works?
Well, you see, initially it was anonymous, so they did not know who was writing these pamphlets that were advocating for the split from England. But she received recognition by the time the revolution was over, and she was writing under her own name. So it was not, she was recognized in her time.
Yeah. Alice, tell us about some of the past Mercy Otis Warren Award recipients and what made them stand out to the committee.
Well, the first one was Marion Vuolamia, which a lot of your listeners may not recognize that name, but she had the longest-running book review TV program on public access TV. And she really, she was a wonderful person who ran that program for years. And so she was the first recipient. That her efforts came under the heading of education. She always wanted to educate the public, and she did it through this book review program. And then we've had Eugenia Forts.
Oh, yeah.
Eugenia Forts was a woman of color who advocated for the rights of minorities her whole life. She was very active with the NAACP and was a very public figure in the town of Barnstable for her whole life. She had a special place at the town council meetings. They had a rocking chair for her.
And you know what? You can see her rocking chair at the Zion Union Heritage Museum. And so they have a lovely little exhibit to Eugenia there. So folks can check that out if they'd like.
Yeah. She was a lovely person, very modest woman, just lovely. And then Judy Scarafile is a very active member of our community. She's one of the very few women who are in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, because she was the head of she ran the Cape Cod Baseball League so efficiently. And then another person is Bonnie Snow from Orleans. Her family has the Snow's department store there. But she had a great interest in the history of Orleans and her community. And she encouraged the citizens to appreciate the historical nature of the town. Another person in 2012 was Michelle De Silva. She established the Cape Cod Cares for Our Troops. It was... She did it with her son, but her son was only 12 years old when he came up with this idea to support the troops by sending them care packages. And so she, you know, organized that effort, which is basically his idea. And it's become a very, very important part of this community in recognizing our veterans. So there's the names of a few people that are diverse.
Yeah, so inspirational, too. And I know you've got a list of all the recipients on your website. So, Mary, part of the criteria for the award is patriotism. What does patriotism and being a patriot mean to you today?
Oh, wow. You asked the wrong person that today. The way things are today, I think that we need to go back in history and start over again. We need to go back to that. You know, I ran for office, as you know, for 30 years, and I never once mentioned my opponent's name. That was something I always said was, and whenever I talked to any other person, I'd say, if they're interested in running, don't talk about somebody else. Talk about yourself. What are you going to do? Yeah. What are you going to do to change things?
Such a good point.
And to see people now talking, you know, call people names and things like that, it really bothers me. And of course, it's a different world today.
Yeah, Mary, I'll tell you a quick funny story. My grandson, who's 8, you know, during the New Hampshire primary, you know, the ads that come on, he got very upset because, you know, one candidate was calling another candidate weak. He says, oh, it's so mean. And I thought, here we try to teach the kids not to name call, and yet here as adults, we're calling names, right? Yeah, so, and Mary, you've always been such a gracious lady, and I'm glad you brought that up. Alice, what does it mean to you?
Well, patriotism to me means being involved in what is going on in your immediate area and being as effective as you can with issues in your own town, and also being well-informed as to what the issues are nationally. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is patriotism. Yeah. Being educated as to what is happening and having some input into whatever you care about in your community. And it can, you know, it can start as small as, you know, being the Boy Scout leader or the Girl Scouts. There are so many areas in which we can participate, and the opportunity is there to do as little or as much as you want in your own community. And that, to me, is how patriotism is defined.
Yeah. So, Alice, what do you see as some of the significant issues facing our region today, and how might these issues influence what you're looking for in future award recipients?
Well, you know, I think that the groundwater is extremely important. I think that is something that has been going on for a very long time. And you know, it's all, you know, energy, the idea that we have to be open to how we can be more energy self-sufficient, whatever path that might take. We have very active citizenry that is involved in, like, with the wind farm and in those issues. But I think that's one of the, you know, the groundwater and energy, I think, are two very important concerns of the residents of on this peninsula.
Yeah. Looking, I'm talking about engagement, what happens on many levels, and I'm thinking of younger women, women of color, Indigenous women, all working on issues of environmental justice, equity, human rights. Talk about how we make sure we're finding and recognizing the women who might be working under the radar.
Well, I think that each organization that people get involved with has that responsibility to see to it that those who volunteer are recognized for their efforts on their behalf. I at the moment, I'm thinking of things like Habitat for Humanity. they have a very, very fine structure under which they have a restore, for one thing. They have some volunteers in that. But the building of those homes is done by volunteers. They have people who organize the actual building, but then they have volunteers that do it. There are many organizations on the Cape that are available for people to use or as a conduit to do for this community.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mary, what do we do to help recognize women who might be working under the radar?
You know, I just have to say that this is a chance to give the county, which helps us so much, a little plug. And I'm thinking of AmeriCorps, and I'm thinking of organizations like that. You know, we've got 15 towns, and every single one of those towns have got the same problems. And we've got this wonderful county that has departments that are next to none. I mean, our health department, the different departments, and there's women who are working in those departments who are doing things. I think that and the respect. I really want to get that word in, respect, because that's the first thing that we need to restore. We need to restore respect.
And go ahead. Sorry, Mary. Go ahead.
And I can see younger women coming up, and I just admire them so much. Yeah. They work so hard.
And I was going to say, if you know somebody, right, this is an opportunity. You can nominate them for the Mercy Otis Award, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we're going to post a link with more information about the Mercy Otis Warren Cape Cod Woman of the Year Award at our website, capeandislands.org. Mary LeClaire and Alice George, thanks for being with us and bringing us the info. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having us this morning.
Thank you. It was great to see you.
Coming up after a break, we revisit a conversation with Liza Monday about the remarkable but little-known contributions of women code breakers in World War II. You're listening to The Point. Women made enormous contributions to the war effort during World War II. In addition to supporting families while men went to the front lines, they filled huge gaps in the labor force. Some estimate that by 1945, nearly one out of every four married women worked outside the home. Women also contributed more directly to the war effort through the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs, program, flying almost every type of military aircraft. Women also worked surreptitiously during the war at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, on the building of the atomic bomb. Another little-known but significant contribution made by women during World War II, the women recruited to work as code breakers. Liza Monday's book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreaker of World War II, chronicles their achievements and the secrecy around their work. Liza Monday, welcome.
Good morning.
So, Liza, you're a journalist in addition to being an author, and you've written numerous articles about the changing role of women in our society. Stories about women, particularly women in the workforce, are on your radar. But the women who worked on code breaking during World War II were sworn to secrecy. So how and when did you first find out about them?
Yes, I found out about it when I was talking to an NSA historian. Our federal historians are great sources of articles and stories, and they were telling me about this the effort of more than 10,000 women to come to Washington and break codes during World War II. And I could hardly believe that the story hadn't been told. And I think it was much like the way that Hidden Figures came to be a book, in the sense that people who worked at NASA knew about the female African-American mathematicians who had worked so hard on the space program. But it took an author who wanted to do the work to bring that story to light, to make it public. And it's the same here, in that it was no secret at the NSA that women had broken codes during the war, and that effort would ultimately lead to the creation of the National Security Agency. But because the women had done such a good job of keeping the secret, the story was not out there in the public.
Yeah, we should. This is in a way similar to the Girls of Atomic City in that you're working on the secret project. You think, well, who would do that? Who would work in secret? But if we remember the time during World War II, if somebody said you're doing this for the war effort, you were going to do it and you were going to keep it secret.
Absolutely. I mean, the people were so eager to help the war effort. I interviewed women about this. They tried to evoke for me the incredible sense of patriotism during the war. One of the women said, people were picking up rubber bands on the street to donate to the war effort. They were, donating pots and pans. They were saving bacon grease. One of the codebreakers in my story, both of her brothers were in the fighting, and the family had actually tried to donate their dog to the war effort to fight as well. Their dog was named Poochie, and they actually received a letter from the War Dog Training Center saying that unfortunately that they had an age limit and Poochie was too old. Right. But that just sort of gives a sense of how really people would have dropped anything
to
serve the war effort. And it was sort of ironically easier for the women to keep a secret because they were told to tell anybody who asked what they did that they were secretaries, that they emptied waste baskets and sharpened pencils. Mm-hmm. And people certainly were willing to believe that, believe that any work that women were doing was probably not that important.
Yeah. So since this group was so secretive, how did you go about your research and what were some of the challenges?
Well, the challenge for us was finding the women, and I did so in all sorts of ways. The NSA put me in touch with a couple of women. I literally, though, had a situation where a colleague of mine was visiting her mother at an assisted living facility in Maine. Her mother is a Wellesley class of 43 graduate, and she was chatting with her mother about my book, and literally two women at the table said I was involved in that effort, and one of them put her in touch with a third. So she came home and she said, well, I've got three people for you to talk to.
Serendipity.
And it was extraordinary. And it did convince me because many of these women were recruited out of the Seven Sisters schools, out of, Smith and Radcliffe and Bryn Mawr, Mount Holyoke, Wellesley. And I'm sure that in the Boston, Cape Cod, whole northeastern area, I bet that almost every assisted living facility has a woman who did this work.
Does, yeah. Now, these women were in their early 20s back in the 1940s, and you found a pretty good number of them that were still alive and ready to talk about this.
Yes, more than 20. And some of them did have to be convinced that it was okay to tell the secret. One of the women in Maine, I really had to convince her that the oath of secrecy that they signed has now been lifted and that the government, in fact, would love for them to tell their story. But I did find more than 20 women really all over the country who in some cases had to be convinced, but ultimately, would all like to get credit for their contributions, completely understandably. And so they were eager and gratified to talk, and it was extraordinary what they remembered. Yeah. I mean, one woman living on Cape Cod who had been recruited out of Smith was able to show me the quite complicated math that she had had to do when she was working on breaking the Japanese naval code.
Yeah, I think she did columns in front of you and showed you how she did it, right?
Yeah, extraordinary. Yeah. Yes, exactly. She drew the columns and she was recovering additives. I mean, basically, it was a numerical code, but it was encrypted by having more numbers added on to the numbers. And she had to figure out what the encryption was and strip it out in order to get down to the real numbers that had the message hidden in them. So these women were decrypting. This was an early form of hacking. They were hacking enemy communication systems, and the systems were encrypted, just like, computerized communications are encrypted today, and computers are doing now what the women were doing during the war.
What were some of the skills the government was looking for in potential code breakers, and how did they go about finding these women?
So it was a fascinating program, particularly that the Navy conducted, working with professors and deans particularly at the Seven Sisters colleges. Much as they had done at men's schools like Harvard and MIT, they contacted math professors, astronomy professors, and asked them to tap certain senior girls who were good at math and science, but also at languages, because both of those skill sets are useful. But they were also looking for young women who were deemed to be patriotic and loyal. When I was doing research at Radcliffe, I came across these amazing files in which administrators were identifying the young women. And one of them said that they hadn't chosen a particular young woman because she had been spoiled by her mother, and they didn't think that she would be able to sort of persist in the work and take it seriously. So they were also looking for young women who were persistent and likely to stick with it, because it is a very hard thing to do, and it does take a lot of tenacity and sort of what we would call grit today, a willingness to withstand frustration and failure until you get to the right answer.
Describe the opportunities for women after college at that time, even for those women who graduated at the top of their class from a prestigious college.
Yeah, and that's easy to do, and it can be done very quickly, because school teaching was really the only job that was consistently available even to the graduates of top women's colleges. Now, there were some women who aspired to go into medicine or law. There were a few schools that had a few spots available for women, but by and large, women were shut out of these professional graduate schools. And, you know, there was a bit of room in journalism for women, maybe who wanted to write for the society pages, but the barriers to professional career in the late 1930s, early 1940s were enormous, even for these very top women. So this was an extraordinary opportunity for them to use their education and their talents in a way that ordinarily would not have been available.
Right. Have the colleges documented this history of their graduates?
Yes, to varying degrees. Wellesley has done a good job of recovering the recruitment program, but I think and Radcliffe to a certain degree, some more than others. When I was researching at the National Archives, I found rosters of all the graduates of these schools who were identified and came in 1942, 1943, 1944. I even found the addresses that they stayed when they came to Washington. So there is a trove of material, I think, that could be used to further build this history. But there was a great article in the Wellesley Alumni Magazine in 2000 written by two female graduates, about those women's contribution to the program. And that was a great starting point for me, actually.
The National Security Agency wasn't created until after World War II, so the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy had separate departments working on code breaking during the war. But they were in competition with one another. Explain that.
Yeah, well, anybody who lives in Washington knows that agencies compete with each other, particularly for appropriations. And during the war, you know, so many of our agencies were established and got started. We really didn't have any intelligence agencies at the beginning of World War II, hard as that is to believe now. We didn't have the CIA, we didn't have the NSA, we didn't have the DIA, we didn't have much in the way of military intelligence. So they were ramping up really, really quickly after Pearl Harbor, which was a massive intelligence failure. And they were competing for glory, they were competing for appropriations, they were competing to be the first to break a code system. The Army was very chagrined because the Navy had broken the Japanese naval code before the Army was able to break the Japanese Army code system, because there were so many different systems. So there was a lot of competition, and there was competition for the women, and they were literally racing to get to certain colleges first. I came across a memo in which some Navy admirals were very angry that the Army had cut in to try and pick off some of their students, and the Army had gotten to Connecticut College before the Navy did, and so the Navy decided that they better at least give up on Connecticut College and let the Army have those young women.
You've got a funny little exchange about Polly Bunderbach and Agnes Driscoll after the war. Now we've got the Navy and the Army merging their operations and moving in, and you have here, even at her advanced age, Agnes Driscoll was capable of taking names and holding grudges. Though they had never been introduced, she must have known that Budenbach, thank you. Budenbach's mentor was Raven, the very man who did Miss Aggie in. As they passed each other in the hallway, neither woman spoke, but Agnes Driscoll did let out an unmistakable Driscoll hiss.
Yes, Agnes Driscoll was really instrumental in developing the Navy's code-breaking program. She was working on the Japanese Naval Fleet Code during the 1930s and diagnosed how it worked. And the only reason that we didn't know about Pearl Harbor, or one of the reasons, was because they had changed the code books. But Miss Aggie, as they called her, got elbowed out after Pearl Harbor when there were some male intelligence officers who were coming in and sort of elbowed her out of the way. And so when this cohort of young women came in from the Seven Sister Schools, including Polly Budenbach, who you just mentioned, they really didn't have access to Agnes Driscoll and the few women who were their predecessors. And so they really weren't able to form alliances. And so that was a very interesting and funny exchange, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of funny, from Polly Budenbach's oral history that was taken later.
Yeah. So what were some of the tasks that these women did once they were recruited?
So really every task you can think of, because the women comprised the bulk of the code-breaking forces domestically for both the Army and the Navy. And there were so many different systems. So there were some systems that consisted of numerical code groups. It might be a 4-digit or a 5-digit code group that would stand for the Japanese word for troops, or debarking, or embarking, or the word for maru, which was a supply ship. And that would be converted into, say, a 5-digit code group. But then, as I said, another group of numbers would be added to that to further disguise it, and that would be radioed. We would intercept it. It would go to the women at the compound. They would set about trying to strip out the encryption, doing really the reverse math. They had some tricks to help them. They knew that the code, if they got down to a valid code group, they knew that it would be divisible by 3, because that was a little trick that the Japanese built in to make sure that the code group was radioed correctly, that it wasn't garbled. So they learned tricks like the garble controls that the Japanese built in. They learned to look for words like shogoichi, which stood for noon position, in which a ship would say exactly where it was going to be at noon the next day, and they could get the message out to an American submarine commander who would be waiting at noon to sink the ship. So they were an assembly line in which they were stripping out numbers to get down to the original code group. Then it would get passed along, sometimes literally by a conveyor belt, to a next group of women who would be reading the code groups and actually, you know, constructing the messages. So it was a very well-designed assembly line, and that's just one code system that I've just described. That was the Japanese Navy. I mean, I could go on and on about the German Navy and the Enigma ciphers and the group of women, the team of women who were working those.
How much did the women know about their work?
It varied. Some of the assembly line women really only knew what they were doing. They knew that it was important, it was repetitive and stressful, but they did know that lives depended on it. But women who were deciphering the Enigma messages, which were completely different, they were scrambled German letters, they would read the finished messages. And similarly, the women at the end of the assembly line with the Japanese naval messages would know what the messages said. And sometimes it foretold the movements of their own brothers, you know, ships or their boyfriend ships. And in fact, the women working the German naval messages knew about the D-Day landing as it was happening because they were reading the German naval messages describing the appearance of thousands and thousands of Allied ships on the horizon. So all during the D-Day landing, the women were reading the German messages. They didn't know how it was going exactly, but they knew that it was taking place, and that was an incredibly dramatic experience for the women. And I did have the memoirs of a Wellesley graduate who described that night very, very vividly.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing when you think about it, you know. And in our age of instant communication now, that wasn't so then, so that would be a pretty amazing feat to be able to do that, you know, as it's happening.
Absolutely. And even now in our age of instant communication, we don't necessarily know how certain battles are going.
True,
and,
true.
You know, in the various wars that we're fighting.
Yeah.
And also to be receiving the account of the opposing force.
Yeah.
It was, I think, very extraordinary and moving for the women.
So these young college women came to Washington, D.C. to work, but they were expected to find their own lodgings, which wasn't easy in the nation's capital during the war. But in many ways, this was liberating for women. Explain.
Yeah, it was liberating. I mean, many of these women, when they were recruited, particularly the women of the Seven Sisters, they were asked two initial questions. Do you like crossword puzzles, and are you engaged to be married? And the first answer, the best answer to the first question was yes. The best answer to the second was no, because they would figure that if you were engaged, maybe you wouldn't stick with the work. Maybe you'd move to be with your husband. But a number of the women actually lied. They were so eager to get to Washington, serve the war effort, and in some cases eager to get out of engagements that they had mixed feelings about, that they said, no, I'm not engaged, even though they were. And Washington for them was an opportunity to live with other women on their own. Many of them had been in colleges where they were heavily chaperoned and their behavior was, constrained and observed. And all of a sudden they were living in group houses. They were living in boarding houses. They were living in dorms. In some cases they were living in barracks when the waves were created. Women accepted for voluntary emergency service and the women could join the military. But they were having a great time. They were exhausted. They were working on, 24-hour around-the-clock operations. So they were working three shifts. They might get off, they might work all night and get off in the morning. But they told me about, they would rent canoes. They would listen to the Washington Opera, singing on barges at the Watergate. They would go to movies. They would listen to chamber music at the Library of Congress. They would go to swing dancing. They would hear Frank Sinatra at the Club 400, go to the Willard Hotel. So they had, it was one of those odd times. They were having a fabulous time. And yet at the same time, they knew that the men that they loved, the men they were related to, the men they were going to marry, were out there fighting in the Atlantic and the Pacific. Mm. So it was a whirlwind.
Yeah.
We're revisiting a conversation with Liza Monday about her book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're listening back to a conversation with Liza Monday about her book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II.
Now, once you track down the actual code girls, you mentioned some reticent to talk, some not so much, the one who still thought she needed to keep it a secret. But had they shared their contribution to the war effort with their families?
They really hadn't. And in many cases, they had spent their post-war years listening to their husband tell their children about his wartime contributions, which of course were significant. But in some cases, the women had made more of a significant contribution to the war, and the women couldn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the women whose memoir I read, she had applied to use her GI Bill to go to architecture school. And she was told that she applied to several top architecture schools. She was denied admission. They said, well, we're holding these spots open for men returning from the war. She said, well, I was in the U.S. Navy. But she couldn't say, and my work sunk a convoy. Mm. She knew that that had happened, but she couldn't tell about it. And so she was denied admission to those architecture schools. But they really didn't think that they could tell anybody, even their husbands, what they had done. And somewhere about in the 1990s, when some memoirs and books about naval code breaking started appearing, some of them might start hinting to their families what they had done, but really none of them had laid it out in any kind of detail.
Imagine the shock of that. You've gone all these years and all of a sudden, mom's hinting or grandma's hinting about, I know all about that. I mean, what a revelation that would be. In the book, you have a picture of Stephen Chamberlain. It says, after World War II ended, Stephen Chamberlain, operations officer for General Douglas MacArthur, declared the codebreakers shortened the war and helped save thousands of lives. The post-war accolades did not mention that more than 10,000 U.S. codebreakers were women. So what were their views about having their contributions kept secret for so long?
Well, I think at first they recognized that this was necessary. Of course, they had been told during the war that they couldn't talk about what they did, and they understood and accepted that even after the war was over, we didn't want the world knowing the extent to which we had been able to break codes, because the World War II was followed by the Cold War, and we continued breaking the codes of communist countries and other countries. And so they understood that we can't reveal sources and methods, and they, most of them went into private life and had children and families, and accepted that. But I think, you know, at a certain point, they did feel as though they had been overlooked. And it must have been quite galling to have a member of Congress on the floor of the House say, you know, I believe that our cryptographers during the war played as an important part in victory as any other group of men, and and have it just completely be not mentioned that that more than half of the code-breaking force was women.
Yeah.
I mean, how could that not irritate you?
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned the Enigma code. What were some of the achievements these women code-breakers had?
Yes, so they were working the German naval codes used by the U-boats. U-boats were, you know, throughout the Atlantic. I think many of us don't realize how menacing they were, because at one point during the war, they were preying on American merchant shipping up and down the Atlantic. So a lot of the women from the Eastern Seaboard were very aware of the U-boats. There were blackouts. They would hear the guns. They would see bits of shipwreck washing up. The women described this to me. Once they got to the naval facility in Washington, they were ultimately running every bit of this code-breaking operation. The Enigma machine, there was Enigma machine in every U-boat, and it had four rotors that would scramble the letters of the messages every day, and that setting would change every day or every 2 days. So the first job they had to do was figure out what the daily setting was, and that took, that was like figuring out a computer menu. They would get the garbled messages that the rotors had scrambled it. They knew where in a message certain German words might appear, like weather forecast in the Bay of Biscay. They knew where that might be, so they would conjecture, you know, that certain letters might really be Bay of Biscay, or Biscaya in German. And then they would figure out the mathematical set of permutations that the machine would have to go through in order to scramble certain letters into another letter. And that was just the beginning. Then they would test it on these big machines. And if the machine got a hit, they would know that they had gotten the key for the day. Then they would plug that key into a smaller machine that would actually decipher the message, which would come out in German. The young women who knew German would translate those messages, and then they would write up a daily intelligence report for the U.S. Navy and also the British Navy, because they were in close contact with the British, who were also working on these codes. In fact, I interviewed the son of one woman who spoke every day over a secure phone line to a colleague in England, and her code name was Pretty Weather, and his code name was Virgin Sturgeon. And they obviously had a communication, you know, daily relationship. They never met each other for their entire lives.
Mm. You mentioned there's 10,000 women, so I know you don't know what happened to all of them, but what happened to these women after the war? I mean, many of them went off and got married, as you said, and they didn't really have careers. They became mothers and housewives.
Right. Many of them, and I would say the majority, went off and went into private life, but not all did. A number of them did get PhDs using the GI Bill. A number of them did stay in the workforce. The woman I talked about who was rejected by architecture schools, she moved with her husband to Charlottesville, where he was teaching, Charlottesville, Virginia at UVA. But she taught herself computer programming. And when they eventually moved to Cincinnati, she became the head of the computer program for the university, you know, like the head of basically computer IT for that whole university system. So a number of the women found their way back into the workforce and the computer industry, and a number of women stayed on with what became the NSA, like Polly Budenbach, a woman named Anne Kara Christie, who rose to become the first female deputy director of the NSA. So they were breaking codes during the Cold War as well, in some cases heading up our code breaking for the East German project, the Soviet project, the Cuban messages. So there was a group of women who were there at the formative stages of the NSA.
And you think about how difficult it was for some of these women to return to a society where no one knew of their achievements and they had little opportunity to continue their careers. I guess some satisfaction in knowing you helped the war effort, but also a bit of frustration, I would think.
Yes, and I talked very, very much so. I mean, it was hard making the transition to regular life, and of course that was true for returning men as well. And some of the women had what their families considered to be PTSD. Mm-hmm. The women in particular working the German naval codes, because they had to work so fast and because the consequences of failure were so drastic, it was very stressful on them. But I was particularly struck, there was one group of women for the Navy who became very, very close friends, and after the war, when they all had to go back into pretty isolated private lives and they missed each other, they started something I'd never heard of called a round robin letter, in which one woman would write a letter, send it to the other woman, she would write her letter, send both of them on to the third woman, who would write her letter and send it on, and it would travel full circle, and when it came back to the first woman, she would write a new letter and then send it on. And that round robin letter continued until my reporting. I mean, I interviewed one of the women who, there were just two women left, and they were sending the round robin letter back and forth. So it got them through really everything that they went through in their lives after the war.
Mm. And I wondered if you'd talk about Dot for a moment, where, you know, Dot never told anybody what she did, and then maybe about 50 years after the war ended, she started to maybe hint a little bit. She didn't want to come right out and say it.
Right. Dot Braden is 97. I'm going to see her again in a week. I talked to her last night. She was a school teacher in Chatham, Virginia, which is down there on the Virginia-North Carolina border, 22 years old, overwhelmed by her teaching load, was recruited by the Army, came to Washington, and was one of a group of school teachers who were sinking the Japanese supply ships, doing the same mathematical procedures I've described. And after the war, she never told anybody. Her children knew that her husband had been a meteorologist during the war. Her children knew that their mother and father had corresponded and even become engaged over letters during the war. They didn't necessarily know that Dot was actually writing to like five or six different men, which was pretty common during the war for women. But they never knew what she did. And they were, once she started hinting at it, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, her children and grandchildren were avid to know more. And in my initial interview where I was trying to persuade her to talk, her son was there with her because he had wanted really all his adult life to know what his mom did. And between the two of us, we convinced her. At one point, she said, well, you know, I'm in my 90s. What are they going to do at this point? You know, put me in prison? And I said, well, it'll probably be a nice prison, you know, at your age. And she laughed. And finally, you know, unspooled this incredible story.
Yeah. And what a gift, 97 years old, to be able to hear firsthand her and the other women who are also, you know, in their 90s. What a great gift to be able to hear from them, their story firsthand.
I was so aware of that. I felt, it sounds cliched, but I felt really very honored that they entrusted me with their story, and I just could hardly believe my good fortune that I would get to work on it and try to, you know, tell it as well as I could.
And now that the book is out, are you getting letters or emails or things from other people saying, hey, I have a story too?
Yes, I am. And it's sort of, I mean, it's great, but it's sort of frustrating. I've gotten probably 30 or 40 emails from people saying, you know, my mother did this work. My grandmother did this work. Here's photos. Oh, by the way, we have audio tapes. Oh, by the way, you know, my grandmother's still alive and living in an assisted living facility and would love to talk to you. So I realize that I could have researched this story for another year or another couple of years. So maybe some of their accounts will show up in, you know, if forward to a new edition or something.
Yeah, I know.
It is great.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can never get everybody that, no matter how many times you're researching, you're not going to find everybody at once.
Right, at a certain point, you just have to start writing.
You have to do it, yeah. The book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. We'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Author Liza Mundy, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.